Jason, we friends just having a conversation.
Wave your hands high.
Don't stop.
Welcome back to North Texas Music Fanatics. I am Jason Janik. Today we have somebody that I've had a million musical adventures with here in Dallas over the years. I've known him since I was like 5 or 6 years old. Let's kick right into it. This is John Jones.
Howdy, sir. Thank you for inviting me into the belly of the mothership to do this little podcast. I appreciate it. It should be fun.
Oh, yeah. I think it'll be a lot of fun. I know that you don't really play any instruments, but you've seen and done so much in the North Texas music scene. I think this will be a blast.
Yeah, it'll be fun. We'll recount some history that's starting to get a little fuzzy in my 49-year-old brain.
So a little side note for everyone listening. As most of you know, you can hear this on deepelumradio.com. Our spot right now is Tuesdays at 7 p.m. and Fridays at noon. We do have the shows archived on Amazon Music. And I just started a Patreon, which would be super awesome if you guys helped out to keep this show going. So let's discuss this. I don't think there's any need to go into our kindergarten era. let's kick into when we were 18 and we got our first apartment together. And we had no money. And yeah. We decided just to go down to like Deep Ellum and Lower Greenville and do what kids do.
Yeah, we had no money, but it almost feels like you really didn't have to have a lot of money to have fun back in those days anyway. We got that apartment off of Skillman, which I would be scared to go visit without like a bulletproof tank right now.
I know, over the last several years I keep seeing every now and then something in the news, someone got murdered there.
But anyway, man, we did the same sortie where we'd get in your truck, start on Upper Greenville, drive all the way down through Lower Greenville and then through Deep Ellum, and we'd do, you know, several laps around there. And that was when, you know, Deep Ellum was certainly possible, but it was before it was on its incline on the way to where it got super crazy, but it was, you know, really fun back then. Of course, you know, one little problem we had was we were 18 and, you know, couldn't get into a lot of places. But of course, you know, with my...
Well, you know, we still snuck into Lasers in the back door and played pool there. And I couldn't afford to go into Trees. You know, you could the X on your hand in Trees, but I didn't even have enough money to cover the cover there. So,
well, the one thing we had going for us is, you know, a lot of these places, if you weren't causing trouble, would kind of look the other way. And I mean, it wasn't like we were going in there and you know, guzzling whiskey and starting a bunch of trouble. I mean, you know, we just kind of hung out and checking out the scene and the music and everything else going on down there.
Yeah, back then, Lower Greenville was a lot different than it is now. Now it's much more foodie, but it had the Royal Rack Club, it had Jay Lee's, it had Record Bar. And then, of course, the place that we spent a ton of time at, which was the Wynedale
Tavern. Oh, man. Yeah, I'll never forget, man, my introduction to the Wynedale was I worked down at Dealey Plaza, not at the sixth floor, but with all the interesting personalities that were basically tour guides slash, you know,
on the fringe.
They definitely a lot of them were on the fringe of society, but they're very interesting people. And Dan was, man, he's one of these people that, I mean, the guy was brilliant, but just, you know, the jaws of addiction were just, you know, firmly wrapped around him. But man, he was a fun, interesting guy. And he loved going to the Wynedale. And we would work down there, and sometimes I would, you know, because he didn't have a car, and, he, you know, he's one of these people, we'll talk about a lot of them, that kind of, if you were, you know, just kind of barely hanging on, living on the fringe, what I mean by that is, you know, you could be kind of a happy alcoholic with a budget, and, you know, if you wanted a place to go crash, there were plenty of rooming houses up along Munger.
Yeah, he was in those boarding houses.
In those boarding houses.
Right past Ross.
Where, you know, if you had a C-note, you could get yourself a week in one of those places and kind of, you know, not be homeless for that week. And he
liked going to Ships, too, if I remember correctly.
Oh, yeah. He went into Ships. He went to this other place called Mimi's. I don't even remember. I think that place closed down a long time ago. Anyway, but Dan loved going to the Wynedale, and I would drop him off there a few times. And one night he called me while we were at home. He's like, "Hey, you ought to come down here and hang out." And I'm like, man, I don't know. I just turned 18, and he wanted me to pick him up, but I don't remember the exact chain of events.
But he wound up wanting to hang out for a while before.
Yeah, he was like, come down here. And so I parked. Back then, you could park on the side of that 7-Eleven, and I remember getting out. Man, I was, you know, young, and I'd never been into that bar before or bar like that. And I walked in. And
technically, that's a 21 and up.
Oh, yeah. That was very technically as well. According to Texas state law, not according to, you know, the unwritten way of how stuff worked down there. But
if I remember correctly, didn't Lola own that? Who Loda. Owned that?
Loda. Oh, that was Loda.
Yes, Loda. That's right.
Loda owned that. And she also, a lot of people don't know this, you know, she used to own the Goat. It used to be called Loda's Goat, and then she sold it, and they just changed the name to the Goat.
And the goat had a lot of music, too, but it was much more karaoke.
And blues and stuff like that. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of overlap.
Oh, yeah, I remember, because they had a little bit of a bikerish band on Fridays. Yeah, that's right.
Well, and the blues guys were there on Thursdays for a long time. So
that's right.
But all right, so
Wynedale.
Yeah, the Wynedale. Now, that night, I went to Dan, called me in there. I walked in, and there's all these, like, rough-looking guys. You know, there's some, like, Harleys parked in front. I walked in, I'm like, and Dan was in there, and he was 30 sheets to the wind. He's like, I don't want to go right now. Why don't you just hang out here? I'm like, I don't know, man. I think I'm going to wait in the car. And I went out there. I remember it was freezing cold, and I pulled a bunch of those newspapers out of the back, and just I was too scared to go in there. So I basically slept in the parking lot, covered in newspaper, waiting on his drunk ass to come out. He finally stumbled out at like 2 a.m., and a week or so later, I went in there and was like, wow, this place is really cool. And then I talked you into going in there, and, you know, next thing you know, 20 years goes by, and we, you know, for part of our early youth, were practically living there, so.
Yeah, no, I remember you saying, hey, we got to go in here. This place is great. And, I mean, my first reaction was probably a little similar to yours, because you go in, and it's rough. It's kind of like one of those bars you see in the movies where, yeah, you know, there's a little dust on everything. There's a guy who's got, you know, a heart tattoo that says mom. There's another guy who's propped up against the bar sleeping type. I mean, yeah. it was.
Yeah.
And for those of you who don't know, the Wynedale is where the Single Wide is now.
Yeah.
It
doesn't look all that different in there now, other than there's no pool table, and they've, you know, it still is a very interesting place.
Well,
you know?
They've made it a lot more kind of fun, kitschy. It was legit kitschy.
Yeah. Yeah. The Single Wide's a great place. I've been there, you know, a handful of times. I'm just very glad they didn't turn it into some douchey bottle service place.
We went in there a couple times when I was shooting for Quick, and I remember shooting the O's with Pedigo and Taylor playing there. That was early on in the O's too. I'd been there a couple times, and I think Single Wide is awesome.
Yeah.
There's a reason why it's survived all this time, and a lot of bars haven't. We're going into the Wynedale. We're under 21, but you know the bartenders are like, as long as you stick near the back and don't drink and don't cause trouble, you can hang out here and play pool. And they had a couple pinball machines there at the time, and they had live music throughout the week.
Yep, they sure did. And it was always a good mix of different types of music too. So
what I loved about the music there, like you said, it was a mix, because I remember Josh Allen played there. And I can't remember what day he played it. Maybe
it's like a Thursday or a Friday.
There was
a time where maybe he played more than once a week sometimes. I don't remember, but he was there a lot. I mean,
oh yeah, he was.
When I think of, you know, Wynedale music, obviously Josh Allen for me is the first name that pops into my head. You know,
100%, because that's the first band that I remember really grabbing on to there.
Yeah,
I remember they had a jukebox and somebody playing Stevie Ray Vaughan there.
Yeah,
I remember a lot of live music and like open mic-ish stuff. And there was a guy who played a bass that was made out of a bedpan. a lot of kooky stuff. And if I remember correctly, the Carsons played on a Wednesday. They had a Wednesday spot.
Yeah, maybe so. I definitely remember that.
Josh may have had Thursdays, or he could have had Fridays. Either way, there was music there multiple nights a week, and we went multiple nights a week.
Yeah.
Especially being under 21 and one of the few places that looked the other way for us.
Yeah. There was always a schedule, you know. You had the open mic, And, you know, and then, of course, later in the, towards the end of the Winedale, there was Dominic and his karaoke, which was,
Right. We covered that for quick as well, too, because I remember doing a full story on that one.
Yeah. Dominic Black, the karaoke master. He was, I mean, he's very
just
much still alive
Dallas,
and
just
kicking
not in
it
Dallas anymore.
In Colorado, but yeah, just not in Dallas, but man, that guy was a master sound engineer. If you were a mediocre singer, he'd make you sound fantastic, and if you sucked, he would make you sound palatable. So
yeah, he knew how to run karaoke, because I remember we followed him to a few different places around Dallas.
Yep.
He was down, what was it called, across street from the Landing that he had a spot at? Do you remember?
Oh man, yeah, one of those places that was it was an Irish place.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, I don't remember the name
of it. And then he, I think he did a gig over off of Main Street.
Yeah, Sole Hollandaise. I don't even know if it's still there.
Oh,
it's a Mexican restaurant.
Yeah, anyways, we saw a lot of stuff. You know, I know there's still a lot of music on Lower Greenville now, but everything I cover there for the Dallas Morning News is food related.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Royal Rat Club is long gone. They used to have a lot of hip-hop there, if I remember correctly, and a lot of reggae.
Yep, I remember that. That place made it till the late 90s, maybe. I mean, it was one of the first casualties of the old gruff Greenville Avenue or the lower Greenville part, right? I mean, it was...
Yeah, I mean, everything that we were hanging out down there is long gone.
Yeah.
I always enjoyed a record bar, and that one lasted mm-hmm. for quite a while. I think the Blind Butcher or whatever it was moved in there after them. Jay Lee's... you know, is a head shop that's long gone.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I mentioned a minute ago, the Carsons. I remember absolutely falling in love with the Carsons. Got to know Scott Stevens. He wound up giving me guitar lessons. Mm-hmm. And I got good enough to where I can kind of, you know, hack out some chords. And
yeah, I remember those guys. Of course, you know, the memories are starting to kind of come back now that I'm looking at the CD cover. And of course, they do a shout out to all these people in the album cover, and I'm looking at that, and that's bringing back even more memories. Whatever happened to those guys, do you know?
Like a lot of bands, you know, they try to make it, and eventually they fade away.
Yeah.
They played Trees a couple times, because mm-hmm. I remember going once there. They played a few other places.
Yeah.
JJ moved up to Oklahoma and started, I think he was doing guitar tech for Wakeland.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just how bands go. I just have my connection to them because it wound up being the first photography I ever had on an album.
Yeah.
You know, which at that time I was like, oh my God, I'm so amazing. This is great. I'm on an album. And,
yeah.
You know, I mean, there's a million of those little bands that had great music that, you know, kind of disappear into the ether. But at the time, it felt like a great achievement.
Well, I'm just trying to think of the different phases, the different eras of the Winedale and all the music and everything else that came along with that. But, you know, if we start that period at 92, when we first walked in there, Josh Allen was already a pretty big staple of the Winedale back then, if I recall correctly.
Yeah,
I mean, it was early 90s.
And he wrote for The Observer, and he did a bunch of other stuff around town.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. He had that kind of a Gordon Keith-ish column in The Observer, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Yeah, wow.
Well, you know what we should do? We should play something either by the Carsons or who else. It makes sense to play Josh Allen.
I think you start off with Josh Allen because he's the beginning of the era that I remember. So I haven't listened to him in a long time, so that'd be great.
All right, well, let's do that right now.
All right.
Second-rate town. leprechaun machine. I chase bus fumes down to New Orleans. Downtown Dallas Depot, cabbies turn their faces. Shoe shine, Sammy can't even tie his own shoelaces. Little dab of Brill Cream, a funeral in Des Moines. Mexican Bambino, swallowed my last coin. All aboard for Pittsburgh. Driving to us, I'm going Greyhound, merry-go-round. Check my life at the lost and found. I bought a first-class ticket to a second-rate town. Riding on the hound. A bullet passes through us. Big rusty fist holds out food stamps for a loan. Tripes in season, brother, you can leave your teeth at home. Rolling, 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 Dramamine or Buzz. That's America out my window. Leave the drive into us. I'm going Greyhound, merry-go-round. Check my life and my wife and my brains at the lost end. A second-rate town.
All right, well, that was great. Josh has a lot of great songs. It just amazes me. You know, I look at my collection of music, and there's so many bands like that.
I seem to remember Josh being good at improvising songs, too, just with whatever the mood was in the,
oh,
in
yeah,
the wine
yeah,
deal.
Yeah.
He would just come up with something, and then, you know, he could direct the whole mood of the bar if he needed to do that, too, with his just, you know, course corrections on what he would play. And sometimes I just think I'm not sure if some of those are cover songs or if he just made them up, but I know some of them had to be made up, but he was good at that.
Oh, yeah, he definitely was. You and I saw a lot of music through the years. I started shooting more for the college paper and then the city paper and then the Dallas Morning News and Quick and the Observer. You assisted me on quite a few shoots.
Yeah, mostly on Quick. That was definitely, I think, you know, a lot of the stuff was you would offer to let me come on some shoots. And for a while, it was just like me in the background having fun. But I think with Quick, I really kind of genuinely helped you out on a lot of shoots because a lot of those were chasing down, having to write down a bunch of stuff. And I was like, well, I'll certainly, you know, put in some labor for a cool experience.
And everyone offered us free drinks and all sorts of crazy stuff. It was a good time.
And a lot of good food.
And I know one of the events that we shot for Quick was Erykah Badu when she was DJing.
I
remember that one.
I remember that too. Where was that again?
It was in there was a club in the bottom of the Jewel, if I remember correctly. We shot at a lot of nightclubs over the years, that was for sure.
Yeah, whole wide spectrum of those.
Was there one of those that you kind of remember being more fun than the others?
Oh, man, of the nightclubs we shot?
Did you go to that big, it was like a four-story one over there, right off of Main and right there by the highway that splits through Dallas and Deep Ellum?
The four-story, didn't we shoot that around the Super Bowl?
Oh, all
that
the Super Bowl stuff
Super
we
Bowl.
Did.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm glad you brought that up.
Yeah.
So we shot a lot of the nightlife stuff around the Super Bowl, and I got a photo of you with Snoop Dogg. Do you remember that?
Oh, I do remember that. I do remember that. I met a lot of people that weekend. I mean, just really wacky. There's a picture of me somewhere with Jared from Subway. I hope you lost that file.
it's funny you mention the stuff. So I'll occasionally syndicate some of my photos after they run in the morning news. I'm allowed to syndicate it wherever. And the stuff that I made the most money off of was Jared, because obviously his horrible story that blew up. And then Randy Travis, you know, right after that, just had nightmare problem after nightmare problem. Right. And so those pictures just kept selling and selling and selling.
Interesting. I didn't know that. I mean, I knew about their problems, but no, that makes sense, I guess, though. But yeah, the Super Bowl, that was crazy because, you know, I always tagged along on the shoots to the point where I got to be friends with, you know, Hunter and Jeff and all that whole crew. I remember when the Super Bowl came up, you guys didn't, I mean, you had 30 events and 4 reporters to cover it. So, you know, Hunter was like, hey, man, you want to go to the Playboy party? And I'm like, what part of me do you think would say no to that? Of course I want to go. Give me the tickets. And, you know, we went. And it was cool. It was the only time I ever took a photo that was actually published in the news was when I went to that Playboy party. And the thing that sucked about it was the photo I got published was Holly Madison. She came in. It was this whole, like, you know, red carpet deal where the press was set up. And it was a few photographers and then the crew from, like, I don't know, whatever those tabloid shows are, like Entertainment Tonight and Extra or whatever.
And, Extra.
Yeah, exactly. And we're set up and, you know, a few Playboy bunnies come in or whatever, and they're getting, you know, and I photographed, because I didn't know who any of them were, but of course I knew who Holly Madison was. She comes in and she was cool. She hung out for a while and chatted us up and, you know, then went on into the party. And I was like, man, I'd really like to get a good shot of like some really cool A-list celebrity or whatever. And I sat there and it got dead after a while. And then after a while, I was like, man, I really got to pee. This is a problem. I'm going to have to leave. But, you know, I'll run and do that real fast. And I told one of the staff there was like, oh, no, let me escort you to the restroom. Like, you know, to get back there. This place was packed. So we bolted back there and I, you know, went to the bathroom real quick, came back out. As I'm walking out, we were making progress and we kind of got to a point where we were stopped by all these people. I bumped into this guy. We're both kind of sitting there. He's, you know, his head was right next to mine. I look over and it's Hugh Jackman. And I was like, oh man, did you just, you know, he just came from the area where everybody was shot. So I just missed shooting Hugh Jackman on that red carpet. And I went back and of course it was just all, you know, there are a bunch of other celebrities like there. There's like, Kid Rock and I don't know, a bunch of other people, but they all like snuck in the back or something. So after that it was over, but you know, at least I got my Holly Madison picture published. You know, that was an interesting night. Cause I actually, for once, actually got a taste of all the work that goes into the back end of what you guys do. Cause I remember getting home at like 1 o'clock in the morning and you guys were like, well, we need you to edit this and get it over and do this. And it needs to be uploaded by 4 o'clock. And I'm like, 4 o'clock, man, I want to go to bed. Like, what? I have to stay up and do work. That's no fun. But, and you do that every night when you go out. So yeah, that's.
Yeah. I had a lot of those nights where I'd shoot till 2 and then I'd be up till 4 editing to get it out on time. And, but you know, that's the way it is. I remember once shooting for Quick, we were at a nightclub down over, it must have been real close to where Neiman's is, and Shaq is supposed to be there. So I get there. There were I think 2 other kind of news guys there, and we were waiting and waiting. And Shaq was supposed to arrive at midnight, but he doesn't get there till 2.
Yeah,
and he comes in, spends about 5 minutes there, and then he walks out. I remember right at the very last second, he comes towards where we are, and I get the shot that I needed. But that dude, he was so tall. I felt like he was my dad, and I was like a 2-year-old toddler. That's how huge the difference is.
Yeah.
It just,
you know, I remember people better than I remember places a lot, and of course I remember having a lot of fun. But I mean, the 2 other celebrity shoots that I remember most fondly are the New Year's Eve party we spent with
Norm Macdonald,
and Tom Green.
That's right.
And
was at that place over
I don't remember if it was a pizza place or they had pizza.
Yeah, but so it's off McKinney.
It is off McKinney.
It's across
Fousey. Was that
Yeah, I think that's what it was. Yeah.
I don't know if I pronounced that right.
Safuzi or something like that. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Quick sent us there several times over the years, and I remember that one quite well. That was New Year's Eve going into 2011.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, and Norm was real cool.
He was real cool. He was very laid back, very quiet. I did get the sense that, you know, he was enjoying himself, but probably would have rather been, you know, home with his family or friends or whatever. Yeah. But he was still nice. And then Tom Green was, he was kind of a riot. He was much more energetic. I think Norm was, ready for bed. But Tom was kind of ready to party. So, yeah, that was a good memory. But the other one...
Now, hold on. Let me guess, because I think it's going to be one of two things. It's either going to be you getting to hang out with Drew Barrymore, or you getting to hang out with Willie and Kinky.
Well, it's both of those, really. I mean, the Willie, obviously, we're going to talk about that because it's music related. Yeah. But yeah, the Drew Barrymore, I wouldn't say hung out with her at all. I mean, I stood in front of her for a couple hours holding your
big umbrella thing. That's right.
While she was like, you know, halfway molested by creepers sitting in line for that thing.
We were hired by her promotions team, and she was doing a signing for her movie, that rollerblading movie that she did. Mm-hmm. And she was so nice and so loving to every fan. Yeah. And there was a line out there that even if she just had like 2 seconds with each one, it would have still been like a 3-hour line. It was a massive line out there. This was over by the Angelica. But she would spend so much time, and somebody would mention something, and then she'd ask a follow-up question because she was so interested in them and sincere. And so everybody was taking like 5 minutes, and her handlers were trying to like force these people out. And one guy came up and was like, "Oh, I actually got to meet your father once." And so her eyes light up, and she's sitting here trying to have these deep conversations with these people that you just can't.
Well, I remember some of that, but I also remember a few people that really overstayed their welcome, you know, and
some
would
of them
just
were
ramble
able to get rid
on.
Of, yep.
And she was like, okay. And there was one dude that looked like, I don't know, a really weird guy, and everybody kind of got child molester vibes from him, I think. And he just wouldn't leave. And it's like, hey,
was he the
dude
one with the big scrapbook?
Matt was that guy.
I remember. I don't know.
Brings a scrapbook.
He was like a homeless Jean.
I don't know, man.
Depardieu type of weird looking
dude was weird.
Yeah.
Anyway. Yeah. And the weird thing I remember what happened was pouring down rain outside. And what happened is one of these promotions where radio stations says, hey, if you're the ninth caller, you get tickets to this, you know, signing.
The
and
screening.
Of course, that was the that was her directorial debut.
She was proud of that.
And so, and they filmed that movie in Austin, if I remember correctly. So she was really doing a lot of press in Texas. But it got to the point where, you know, there's 100 people in this line, and these people
are
taking...
It was more than 100.
Yeah, probably so. And it was pouring down rain outside. And finally, they were running out of time, so they're just like, lock the door, shut the door. So all these people are in line that got tickets promising to meet her, and they just got shut out. And I remember two things is somebody out there was super pissed and started beating on the glass. And I remember her bodyguards all of a sudden started looking really nervous, like something was about to go down. And I started getting a little nervous myself, too. Of course, I could tell, you know, you've got the guys in uniform and then you've got the other guys that look like ninjas that are sitting over in the corner that probably have Uzis in their jacket and they're, you know, looking at what's going on. But anyway, I remember that. And then I remember there were two little girls, probably 5-6 years old, and they just had their face pressed up against the glass window like, oh no, you know, I this has been my dream to meet her. And she saw them and she pointed at them and she's like, no, those two little girls, you have to let them in. So she sent her people to open the door and let those two little girls come in, and they walked up. And one interesting thing is I spend probably too much time on Reddit, but every now and then on Ask Reddit, somebody will say, who has met a celebrity in real life and, you know, thinks they're the coolest person or whatever. And every time somebody asks that question, Drew Barrymore's, there's always a story about how cool she is. So I do think that she's like the real deal. But I will also say that same time, I felt very sorry for her because I could tell, you know, she can't just grab her boyfriend and go sit down in a Starbucks because 80,000 people
every,
would come up.
Everybody
at that
wanted
point
her,
where
yeah.
I'm like, man, I would never trade places with somebody that famous. I mean, I'll take their money, but I would not, you know, all the freedom that we have that we take for granted to just go do what we want, man. I mean, those people either you got to have bodyguards with you or, you know.
No, that's 100% true. I was on Andrew Sherman's Dallas Famous podcast, and one of the things we talk about is when you get to a certain level of notoriety, and I was at a point, especially with Quick and doing all the Bowling for Soup album covers and the stuff that I had done with Rhett Miller, and then I wound up having my gallery show, and I was on the front cover of Quick, and so people could put a face with a name, and I'd walk into almost any restaurant, nightclub, wherever, and there would be people there who knew me that I didn't know, and it's an uncomfortable feeling for sure. And this was nobody famous, versus somebody being actual famous.
Right.
It's a million times tougher on them.
Yeah, I mean, she could be at a Starbucks in Madagascar, and you know, she would get probably mobbed by fans. You know, I certainly would not want that.
Yeah, it's
kind of notoriety at all. So
it's a really weird feeling, and that's one of the reasons why all the musician friends that I have, I don't fanboy them. I understand that they get that so much that I just try to be respectful, and I'm like, hey, you know, we work together, we do some cool stuff together, but I'm not going to try to get a piece of you the way that
right.
some people do.
Mm-hmm.
On the flip side, I do remember being hugely awestruck when I got to meet Willie backstage. Let's talk about that. So, you've assisted me on a lot of great shoots.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them, there was a magazine called American Profile. Yeah. And the cover story was on Ray Benson and Willie.
And Asleep at the Wheel.
Yes, Asleep at the Wheel. It was like their 50th or something. It was
their
40th.
Yeah.
And so we go down to Austin and we get special access to everything. We shoot Ray after the sound check, and then we get to go backstage and hang out.
Yeah.
And tell me about that.
Basically. Well, yeah, we got there. I remember getting there about 2 p.m. and walking in. I forget the name of what was the name of that arena we were at? I mean, it doesn't matter. But anyways, somewhere in Austin, and we get there about 2:00, walk in, and these guys all Asleep at the Wheel. If I remember correctly, I'm probably wrong about this. So I guess there have been like 70 or 80 members over the life of the band, and this is their 40th reunion. And I want to say 40 or 50 of the original 70 actually made it to this concert. And so they were in like pre-rehearsal where they're just kind of, you know, warming themselves up. And a lot of them were just kind of dressed in like, you know, sweats and flip-flops or whatever. And just kind of doing an informal jam. But we got to walk around and meet those guys. The whole, you know, just walking around in that stage and seeing all of the different setups and these slider things they pull. I don't know what you call them or whatever, but that was an experience in and of itself being back there. But
the production that goes into shows is always impressive. So, I mean, even some of the stuff that I've seen at like a Simple House of Blues stage, and I've gotten to know a lot of the guys who work behind the scenes, and just to see the stuff that they do and make shows happen is pretty impressive.
Mm-hmm. Those guys were all really cool, and I remember talking to several of them and just kind of hearing their stories about, you know, not just their history with the Sleep of the Wheel, but a lot of them had been in other bands and just, you know, I moved to Nashville in 72 and I did this and was in this band and all that. But a lot of these guys have just, you know, they spent their life on the road with different bands. And of course, we were really, really hoping that we would get to meet and or hang out with Willie at some point. And we didn't know when he was going to show up. And for a while, it didn't really matter. We were just taking in all of the happenings around us. And of course, these guys went from, you know, an informal rehearsal, and then they took a break and were hanging out. And then they kind of got, you know, started doing their full dress rehearsal. And as the evening wore on, we got closer and closer. I think they went on stage. I think that place opened at like 7:00 and then the show started at like 7:30 or 8:00 or something like that. And then finally somebody says, yeah, you know, Willie's bus, you know, pulled up out back. And I remember right after that, we did our private shoot with Ray. So Ray came down and you shot him in one of the seats. It's right. It's, you know,
yeah,
probably half
correct.
An hour before they opened the doors. And, you know, he was sitting down, and I remember, you think there might be a chance we could, you know, get on Willie's bus and hang out? And I remember Benson saying, well, listen here, boys, I'm going to tell you, Will is a nice guy, but he hates photographers. And I'm like, well, wait a minute. And I'm like, does he hate photographers, or does he not like having his picture taken? He's like, well, yeah, that, I mean, it's more or less that, you know. I mean, he, and I understand that, man. I wasn't going to throw a camera in his face and want to take selfies with him, you know.
Well,
I
definitely he's got to, stuff on his bus that he doesn't want photographs.
Well, that too. And I guess that was what, and was that in 2009?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think even then everybody knew he smoked the pot, but, yeah, I can see that. I remember we went up and there's a line of people and they were, you know, Willie's, somebody said it was his brother. I don't know. It kind of looked like a man, but the guy was quite a bit older, but he took one look at us as it's like, nope, you're not getting on the bus. And
well,
so
not we, you, because I had set up backstage because I had some prints that I wanted Willie to sign. So I was waiting there, and then you went out back by his bus.
Mm-hmm.
And the next thing I remember is you walking in the door with a big, huge smile on your face because you got a chance to hang out with Kinky Friedman.
I guess I can tell this part of the story. I mean, I'm never going to run for Congress, so... So here goes. This was after the band had already started playing, and we figured out, okay, Willie's going to hang out on the bus until right before it's time for him, you know, to go on. And at the time, let's see, why. Well, I guess I still smoked cigarettes at the time, so I would have gone out back to the loading dock and smoked a cigarette. And I walked out there, and there's a couple of people from the band, and I started talking to this one lady. I don't know, she was one of the... I forget what instrument she played, but we had talked earlier in the day and kind of had a friendly thing going on and started talking to her. And all of a sudden this guy taps me on the shoulder and he's like, hey man, you want to smoke a joint? And I'm like, okay. And he pulls out a joint bigger than the biggest cigar that I've ever seen in my life. It was, and I've never seen a joint that big or even a cigar that big, man. It was enormous. And I was looked at it and was like, damn, okay, sure, yeah, fire that thing up. He did, and he passed it to me, and I took a little hit off of it, and turned around, and Willie Nelson standing right next to me, talking to the lady that I was talking to on my other side, and, you know, I just kind of froze when I saw him, and let him, you know, finish his conversation with her, and he turns around to me, and he's like, well, how you doing, what's your name, and I was just like, I'm JJ, and oh man, it's, you know, I said something cheesy like, oh, it's an honor to, you know, to finally meet you. It's one of the greatest moments of my life, getting to meet a legend like yourself. And we, you know, chatted there for a minute. He's like, eh, you know, he looked at that, saw that I had a joint in my hand. He's like, you know, are you going to, is that a microphone? Are you going to pass it over here? So I did. And he took a big drag off of it and was looking me right in the eye the whole time. And passed it back, and you know, we kind of said goodbye or whatever, and he, you know, walked up the ramp and went right on stage. I mean, he passed a few other people saying, you know, goodbye or whatever, saying, talking to them.
Yeah, and then
as soon as he walks away, Kinky Friedman comes like bouncing down the bouncing down with this female companion that was you know, quite a bit his junior, but they looked like they were having a blast. And Kinky just, you know, kind of floated on in there, and he was in a really happy mood. And then he decided he needed a hit of that joint too, so it passed it over to him, and hung out there for a while. And that was by chance the second time that I had met him. So
yeah, I remember right after Willie left you, he walked in backstage, and I had some prints laid out for him to sign because I often get asked to donate stuff to charities, to galas, and so he was nice enough to sign some prints, and he was just a really cool dude. And then he goes on. I see you come through the door. You are just grinning like the biggest grin I've ever seen.
Yeah,
well, you look like a kid on Christmas Day.
I just met Willie and Kinky. I just smoked a joint.
Yep,
so,
and you walked up to me, and the first words out of your mouth were, "Dude, I just got to smoke weed with Kinky Friedman."
Well, I spoke to Willie too. Certainly, yeah. I said something.
I just
about
remember
that,
you. Yeah. I remember you mentioning Kinky. I got some one-on-one time with Kinky a year or two later, shooting for the Dallas Morning News. It was a super nice guy.
I told him that story,
and he laughed. It was.
It was at the barbecue place. It wasn't Smoke. It was a different venue.
No, it was. It was over at Reunion. I think at the Hyatt or whatever it is over there.
Yeah.
And I can't remember what it was even for. I just remember he was really cool, and he was asking me questions about stuff, and he was like, "So, you know, tell me your story." I think he's one of those guys that loves to hear other people talk because it helps him build his story.
Yeah.
You know, he can get stuff to write about and talk about by meeting people.
Yeah, that's a good point.
We are obviously having some fun talking. We should take a break for another song. Normally, I try to do every 11 or 12 minutes another song, and we're probably a good 20 minutes into this segment. So I think we definitely should take a quick break and play something. Obviously, we talked about Ray and we talked about Willie. What if we play something by Asleep at the Wheel? Or would you want to play something by Kinky? What do you want to hear?
How about something by Kinky?
I think that's a great idea. Let's do that right now.
It won't take you very long to figure who inspired this song. I've seen your cruel brutality, but you ain't heard the last from me. I'm gonna buy some sandals, throw out my shoes. I'm gonna protest you, it's true. I'm gonna protest you. I'm gonna protest you. Well, Germany and Italy, Mexico and France, Berkeley and Columbia had their chance. Call me a pig or a hawk or a dove. I'm gonna demonstrate my love. Well, a flower and a Gatling gun will do. I'm gonna protest you, it's true. I'm gonna protest you. I'm gonna squawk, baby, I'm gonna shout. Ain't no fun being a new left out. I'll wave me a sign for everyone to see. She's on fire to me. And I'll paint my body green and blue. I'm gonna protest you, it's true. I'm gonna protest you. I'm gonna protest you. Your neighbor's gonna think I'm awfully weird. They'll be peeking out the windows at my great big beard. And I bet your papa's gonna snap his wig when I call him an aristocratic fascist pig. Well, I won't take a bath for a month or two. I'm gonna protest you, it's true. I'm gonna protest you. I'm gonna protest you. Well, I ain't no fan of Chairman Mao, but I wanna see some action now. And there ain't no telling what I might do. I'd rather be red than blue. I'll buy some sandals, throw out my shoes. I'm gonna protest you, it's true. I'm gonna protest you, it's true. I'm gonna protest you.
All right, Kinky. Yeah, that was some good stuff.
It was, man.
Well, yeah, we
the whole experience was great.
I know that you and I have a lot of connections to Texas music over the years.
Yeah, you definitely more so than me, but I tagged along for a lot of it. So,
You did more than just tag along.
You
assisted and even acted in some of the music videos that I've done. We'll talk about that in a minute.
Yeah, that.
And you know, your connection, it's one of those 6 degrees because your sister first introduced me to Ashley Lear, was Ashley Cromines.
Cromines, yeah.
I mean, it's a small world when you really break it down.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so we did a lot of stuff. We did a lot of Tripping Daisy stuff in the 90s and early 2000s, or in the 90s.
Yeah,
and then it switched to the Spree in the early 2000s.
I thought about it, and I think I've been to more Tripping Daisy concerts than any other band. So we went to, I don't remember the, well, I remember, was it the Lure Tour when they were the Hula Poppers?
That's exactly
that.
The one I was thinking about. So with Tripping Daisy, I first saw them, I was out. I can't remember why you weren't there that night, but Ryan and I were out in Deep Ellum.
That's probably why I wasn't there.
and I remember we were down there hanging out, and Trees closed down at 2 a.m. They put away all the alcohol, opened the doors, and since it was after 2 and no alcohol, they were like, everyone can come in. And Tripping Daisy took the stage, and I had no idea in 93 who they were at the time, but they absolutely blew me away.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to stay for the whole thing. And I remember Ryan being like, I want to go, I want to go. And I so regret not seeing the entire set that night. But I caught, you know, probably five of their songs, mm-hmm. and was a fan ever since.
Interesting. I didn't know how you discovered them.
Yeah.
So
you know,
I've never heard that story before.
I moved away to Wisconsin for a little bit.
That's right. You did.
And then I come back and we get another apartment, a nicer one that's not in Sketchtown. And
that we got evicted from, but that'll be
that's a
that's
different
another
story.
Podcast. Yeah.
Yeah. And then I remember us catching a bunch of Tripping Daisy shows. The first one that really sticks out that you went to, was at the Galaxy Club Lore Tour. And,
I remember Tim DeLauder just kind of hanging out before the show, talking to everybody.
Yeah,
and,
exactly.
You know, always seemed like a really down to earth guy. I mean, he still is. You can see him at their restaurant sometimes, and they're taking care of things.
Oh yeah, Loungeer.
Loungeer. It's a great restaurant. If you haven't checked it out, you should.
Yeah, Tim's always been good to his fans. So I wound up one semester, because I was still in college at the time, I went up printing up some 8x10 black and whites and mailing them to the band. And not long after, I got an email from Julie, and she was like, you know, we've got some shows coming up, and we need to hire a photographer. I like the stuff that you sent us.
So that's how you got that gig?
That's how I got it. Good. Isn't it weird?
Way to hustle, man. Good work.
You know, it's funny, because 99% of the gigs that I've gotten, they're all referrals. You know, people know me, and they're like, oh, you got to use this guy.
Yeah.
And
once you have a reputation, it's easy to get referrals.
Yeah, so, yeah, that's true. But the two things that I got on my own like that, it was Tripping Daisy, and then my first shoot for Spin Magazine. It was, you know, cold call. So, I mean, it just worked out well. She was like, hey, you know, we've got a show coming up at Curtain Club, and so let me hire you. And after that, you know, I was shooting all their North Texas shows for their website. And this was back when, you know, the internet was still young and not much
AOL,
content.
Dial-up.
Yeah, exactly.
Tough to download good photos back then.
But Tripping Daisy always had this cutting edge, gorgeous website, and they had a forum going, and they had a big media section. And so that's why we wound up seeing so many shows, because I was shooting all our shows for their website.
I do remember that. I remember you had a line to get us in. So.
Yep. And I remember us going up to, do you remember the show that we went up to Denton? They were playing.
Yes. That was a great show.
It was a benefit show. It was, and the reason why it was so great.
Were they dressed up in those animal costumes, right?
No, I think you're thinking of the one at, that might have been at Rick's. It was called, what was it? The Summon Donkey?
The Nodding Donkey?
Was it the Nodding? That's what
Maybe.
I thought.
Yeah.
So anyways, they take the stage, and Tim has strep, and he still powered through it. And that just, he couldn't hit every note.
Is that why
note.
I got strep 2 days later? No, I'm kidding.
But he couldn't hit every single note, but he still, everything
still
that he hit was
it
awesome.
And everybody loved it, yeah.
It amazes me just how powerful and professional and amazing Tim is.
His voice is, man, it's unbelievable. I mean, when he comes on the radio, you definitely know it's them, because he's got that very distinctive voice. So
little soft, little southern,
yeah,
but very, very commanding. We also did some stuff with Bowling for Soup. Listeners may remember the name John being name dropped during the White Rock Lake photo shoot.
Yeah. I was the one that kept everybody from getting electrocuted, because I was I was holding the battery above the lake, so Janet could shoot these guys. But
that was February 2011, and if everyone remembers, that was the same rough time as the Super Bowl, when we got snowed in and there was still a ton of snow on the ground. The lake was probably 34 degrees Fahrenheit. It was just above freezing.
It was
so cold. After shooting in the studio, we were like, let's just go out and see what we can find. So I'm like, let's go to the lake. We go to the lake. I'm like, let's get in the lake. We get in the lake.
I just want to interject here. I remember the idea to get in the lake, and I thought, wait a minute, guys, we don't have any towels.
Exactly.
How about I run to my house and I get some towels? Because, you're going to get out of that lake and it's going to suck. So, I ran home and got a bunch of towels.
We did not plan ahead. And thank goodness you and I both had houses, within a mile or so. And so you went and got us towels. Because when we got out of that lake, we were wet and cold and shivering.
You guys were. I didn't get in the lake, but I remember.
I don't think you're even legally supposed to get in the lake.
No,
like that.
I don't think so.
Let's just not tell the police.
I think the Dallas police have bigger fish to fry at this point. But yeah.
Yeah, that turned out to be one of my favorite Bowling for Soup photos. So if you go to my Instagram, I've got that photo up on my feed somewhere. You can take a look at it. The Ray Benson American Profile cover. I've got that somewhere in there too, just in case you guys are playing along and want to reference what we're talking about.
Yeah. By the way, he's freakishly tall too. I mean, you said something about
Ray.
Jack's
height. Oh my goodness, yeah, Ray
Benson's
was tall.
A good 6'7" or something. I don't know, but yeah, he's with his hat on, he's probably over 7 foot. I would just say
he's a tall guy. So yeah, well, but you had hung out with us on some other Bowling for Soup stuff too, hadn't you? I'm trying to remember.
Yeah, there was at least two or three photo shoots that we did. And I mean, I remember that one at the lake. I remember.
Did you go to the one that we did at House of Blues?
Yes, I did do the one that. Yeah, I did do the one at House of Blues too. So there's those two that I remember pretty clearly, and there's some other ones that.
Yeah, my nephew Harrison came along to that one. He was a huge fan. He was excited about that.
Harrison was there,
and they were so nice to him.
And I don't remember the context of the other times that I was around for some of that, and it may have just been more of like a, hey, I'm going to be doing this. You want to just show up because I can get you in, and I didn't really do anything. I don't remember, but yeah.
So the House of Blues one, I remember, so we shot them. They held...
Was that the one where Mark Cuban and all those guys were there? Or was that something else?
Oh, yeah. So we did a lot of stuff at House of Blues over the years, especially for Quick. And the one with Cuban, I remember that one now. That was something different. That was up in that the foundation room.
Yeah, it was the first time I'd ever been up there. It was super cool. That was some kind of charity thing, too, because it was a bunch of the Dallas Cowboys were up there, too. I don't remember who all it was, but I do remember there was some kind of a... wasn't the Fray playing that night at House of Blues, and then we went to a party up there? I don't know. I'm probably going off on too much of a tangent.
Somebody was playing downstairs, because I remember we went to both.
Yeah.
Yeah, I forgot about that, because I always, when I think about Mark, I've met him a couple times, and he's not as tall as Ray or Shaq, but...
No,
he's taller than me,
yeah,
and he carries himself even taller than that. Mm-hmm. So he's just got a confidence
just carries
about
himself. Yeah, well, and he doesn't. I think he's what 65 now. He didn't look 65, and he was way older than us when we met him. And I remember thinking, you know, he just doesn't. He doesn't act his age, and he doesn't look his age. So yeah,
and he's very humble and very nice. AT&T hired me once to shoot him, and he was hanging out with a bunch of kind of up and coming entrepreneurs. And he was just, again, it was just like with Drew, where he was so genuine, he was interested, he was sincere. We've been lucky enough to meet a lot of really nice people who are just good people.
Yep.
And that's nice to know. Even with Ray, you know, Ray was busy that night because it was a big night for him, but he was so nice to us.
Yeah, I mean, even a lot of the bar owners, the establishment owners, places, of course, they were really super nice to us because we were given, you know, free publicity. But
but at the same time, I've gotten to know a lot of the bar owners over the years, and some of them are just good guys.
Yeah, some of them.
Good guys and girls, I should say.
There was that one that made a big deal that didn't we just like walk out of there because they wanted to, don't you remember that?
I don't know. I've had a few awkward things over the years.
This was really awkward. I don't remember. The guy was just an absolute douche, and I think we got to the point where it's like, okay, well, if you don't want your bar advertised in the paper for free, we can just walk our happy asses out of here.
Well, you know, I don't want to be too negative about people, because I'm sure
yeah.
I'm sure they all have their good days and bad days, but my biggest thing that I remember as far as not being a fun shoot was when I photographed Jane Goodall.
Uh-huh.
And she's
really?
Yeah, she's nice.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, I remember walking out of that shoot and being like, "Ugh. I had a much nicer picture of her beforehand."
Really? Well, what happened? I mean, you got to tell us a little bit about it. I mean, did she like what? Was she like fart in the middle of the shoot or something? Or
that's exactly it. She had learned that the dominant gorilla is supposed to fart in the middle.
Wow.
Yes, no. Yeah, so...
She's just not...
I think it was just an off day for her. I've seen her talk afterwards, and I've seen a bunch of stuff about her, and she's really nice.
You know,
everybody has an off day.
Yeah. Well, if you stick your career on living in, you know, solitude with a bunch of gorillas in Africa, maybe you don't like being around people that much. So maybe it was that. I don't know.
I don't know. I remember being backstage with Colin Powell. And
that would have been a good one.
It was so surreal because here's this guy that you see on C-SPAN, the news, and all this stuff. And I mean, somebody who's basically shaped how the world is through his career. Yeah. And he had a slight cold that night, and he was like, you know, I apologize, I've got a cold. Hopefully, I don't pass it to you. And
he's like, let's do Jaeger shots.
Yeah. Then he started doing handstands and pulled the keg over. No, he was actually pretty cool too.
He seems like he would have been interesting fellow.
99.999% of the people that I've met have all been awesome. Yeah. And I think that's probably why they're as popular as they are, because you can't be a crappy person and make it too far.
Now, Colin Powell would have been an interesting guy to meet, even though he lied about weapons of mass destruction. But hey, that one little thing, I mean, you know.
Well, yeah, it's the same way with when I photographed George Bush. And, you know, everybody, you kind of had to preface those things and be like, you know, I understand that some of the stuff they did was not great. But then when you meet them in face-to-face and you're like, oh my God, I understand why people do surround you and stand up for you. And,
yeah,
I mean, Bush was a cool dude. He was like the kind of guy that, you know, he'd be there maybe the uncle at Thanksgiving, mm-hmm. and you'd sit down with him and you'd both open a beer and you guys would chat about just the funnest stuff. Bush was cool.
I mean, he would totally be like that. And I mean, there's people that I think, this is a really cool person to have a beer with. I wouldn't vote for him for dog catcher, but, you know, it'd probably be a fun Thanksgiving. Would probably be more fun if they were hanging out at the table or something, you know.
Imagine going to Thanksgiving and you walk in and you see your mom and you see your sister and you see Colin Powell and you see George Bush and you see Drew Barrymore and Kinky Friedman. That would be a fun Thanksgiving.
That would be a fun Thanksgiving.
All right. Well, we got away from music a little bit. Let's get back into music. There's some stuff that we have done, and it was just absolutely fun. I've done a number of music videos for bands over the years, and you've worked on those with me.
Yeah, well, I gotta say, I mean, out of all the, you know, the Von Erichs, Lord Baltimore stuff we did with Jason Vandergriff, the two videos we did for the Baltimores was fun. The Lord I Pray thing with the Von Erichs, that'll always be a special memory because we got to work with Bob for the whole day.
Yeah, and Bob Crawford.
If I remember correctly, when we went to pick Bob up that morning, he answered the door with no pants on. And that was kind of a harbinger for how the rest of the day went.
Bob doesn't drive, so he gets a lot of rides from people. And for this shoot, we were like, you know, We got him some wardrobe, and we got him a new keyboard.
A giant keyboard, like the size of a church organ.
so many people months after, they were like, God damn it.
Bob bumped into me with this huge keyboard.
He got a new keyboard, and it's twice the size of his old one. And that was our fault, yes.
Well, it wasn't really our fault, because he said he wanted this monstrosity of a keyboard, and we were like, dude, you walk like several miles a day, and are you sure? You sure you want this? Oh, that's just what he wanted. We tried to talk him out of it.
But he carried till it broke. Like,
you know, that was the deal. We would buy him the keyboard that he wanted if he was in the music video. And I think he lost it pretty quick after, or somebody stole it or something. I don't know. I heard some kind of story about that, but yeah.
Well, yeah, so that was a fun shoot, though. So I had done a lot of video documentary work, but I think that was my first music video. And Jason Vandergriff was nice enough to trust me with it. And that thing just turned out. I love watching that video. I'm usually very critical about my work, and I try to look at it from a point where it's not my work, so I can say, okay, this needs improvement, that was good. But I feel like when I watch that video, I love that video.
Yeah, it's a great video.
It was really nice to work in so many locals and get Bob and get scenes from Deep Ellum. And at the time, I think it was LaGrange and not Three Links that we used their stage.
It was.
And then we went downtown to Dealey Plaza, and then we went over to like East Dallas.
And there was a lot of prep for that. Of course, I didn't take part in a lot of that, but I was very curious how you built the
narrative,
the actual equipment, the tracks and everything. And I remember, you know, it looked very, very professional. I think it was the first time you had ever, what's the proper name for camera, you know, like the little railroad tracks,
so that you can do the pans and stuff. Yeah. So, I mean, back then stuff like that was so expensive.
You either
were doing a serious production that the video was $10,000, or you did a video like this where you're spending $2,000 and you're making half your equipment. And I recently started following somebody on Instagram. It's called Shitty Rigs, and it's all this stuff where you know these videographers are rigging up their own stuff to make these shots happen. And I mean, that's exactly what it was. You know, I went and I got some wood, and I got some L-channel metal, and I got some rollerblade wheels, and I rigged up so that I could make these, you know, really pretty professional pans. It was probably about 6 or 8 foot of track, and you do this little 2 second pan, and you know, you had to make do with what you could to make the shots. Yeah, so we had on that shoot, we had Mei Chun was our second shooter.
Yeah,
and she got some gorgeous footage. Mm-hmm. But it helps that song is so strong. It's a really strong song. I could count 3, maybe 4 Von Erichs CDs, and out of all her music, that's my absolute favorite song too. So, mm-hmm.
Yeah, I remember shooting that day, and it was cool because there was a lot of scenes where it was only 1 or 2 or 3, so the rest of us would kind of goof off and play around and get to know each other and help out where we could. But yeah, that was a fun day.
And
until we ran out of Cheez-Its, and Bob got really pissed off when that happened. But other than that, man, everybody was a joy to work with on that.
So that band kind of dissipates. He goes into some other stuff. I did another video for his next band. And then not too long ago, he decided to do a project. And it's all, or 99% instrumental stuff. It's a very kind of 70s B-movie sound. It's a gorgeous album. And he's like, I want to do a bigger project. I love the videos that you do. Let's go ahead and try something a little bit different. And for that, we pulled you in front of the camera. Mm-hmm. What all do you remember about the Lord Baltimores?
Probably not as much as I should. but about the Lord Baltimores as a band, or about the experience of the shoot?
About what you were
involved
with.
Well, I remember not really, and I guess maybe partly on purpose, I didn't want to you know, grill you down and you know, admittedly, sometimes you are a little short on details about things.
But that's on purpose. So yeah. I'll tell you this. I try to leave things as open-ended as possible so that the thing can organically and naturally develop into what it's supposed to be.
Well, I was trying to figure out, okay, who is this character I'm playing? And the best I could do is, you know, I might be good, I might be evil, so I'm just going to pretend like I'm like playing a bouncer at a club that, you know, might be a douchebag, but at the end of the day, I'm trying to protect some crazy person from breaking into the club. You know, I wasn't real sure. So I just kind of did that. And I mean, honestly, it wasn't real hard to just, you know, I mean, I already have a shaved head and, you know, those, so I'm automatically a good villain. So I just put some sunglasses on and just, you know, kind of did my thing. So,
yeah. So that first song, the idea was to do a video for every track. And I don't think we got that far. We wound up doing 3 of the tracks. Mm-hmm. And that first one was supposed to be kind of in the middle of the story.
That's right. It was 3, wasn't it?
Yep. Yeah. Okay. And it was supposed to be more of a dream sequence. The mm-hmm. The protagonist, the young girl, is almost kind of imagining the stuff that she sees in the park, and you don't know if it's really there or not.
Mm-hmm.
And she's taking some secretive package from point A to point B, and you were the point B where she drops it off.
Yeah.
And at that point, it was a situation where you were just a character that we may never see again.
But
then it slowly developed into you're possibly the second most important character in the whole narrative.
Yeah, which, meaning the primary antagonist. And at the other point, I was just, you know, neutral, you know, almost just like an extra.
Yeah, so we slowly develop as we realize, okay, we've got this dream sequence video done. Let's get into more of the meat of the story. And it, like you said, it was open-ended. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And we let the story develop itself. In the next video, we're at the diner. What is that, Jay's?
Jay's Breakfast and Burgers.
Over in Addison.
Yeah, over in Addison. Another place I will freely give a plug to if it's, you know.
And if I remember correctly, they also had owned the Metro at one point.
Did they? I didn't know that. That might be true.
I'm pretty sure that's the case. I know that they owned at least one or two other iconic diners that were here in Dallas over the years.
Well, that makes sense. Well, they're doing something right because their food's good and cool. They've been around.
Cool people over there.
Yeah, a long time.
So then we go in and we develop the end of the story. Like I said, we shot them all out of order on purpose. And in that one, you turn out to be a much more mean kind of villainous guy.
Mm-hmm.
And you wind up dying in the end.
Yeah. I remember just, you know, you telling me, hey, you're going to die on the bathroom floor. And I'm like, can we do it in the women's room, please? I'd really rather, you know, take my chances in there.
And then we shoot the third video for that album. And on that one, we find out a little bit how you come into the story to begin with.
Yep.
Because the protagonist, the little girl, she's trying to track down her mother, mm-hmm. and she comes to you for help because her mother's in a situation that she shouldn't be in.
Yeah.
And that, so that was the
most... Yeah, I got to kill a pimp in that one. That was fun.
Yes, you did.
Yeah.
That was interesting because that's over at the motel here in McKinney.
Mm-hmm.
And that place, talk about sketchy places.
It was scary, and you know, we were shooting the scene, and in terms of the storyline, I knew at that point it was starting to kind of come together in my head what was happening here, and it was obviously ended up being kind of a tit for tat situation with me being kind of the good bad guy and, you know, killing the pimp and freeing the mother. But then obviously at that point she kind of becomes an indentured servant of my
she owes you for,
she owes for me help. for that.
That's
so
correct.
yeah
I love the music from the Lord Baltimore's. It's just, it's so layered, it's nice.
Very unique. Yeah, I remember I hadn't really heard the music before we shot that first one, and we're listening to it and thinking, wow, this wasn't what I was expecting. This is interesting.
Well, I think that would be nice to close out with them, or we could close out with Von Erichs. Who all did we talk about this last segment? Let's close out with some Lord Baltimore's.
Let's do that.
That's some great stuff. So, I mean, we could probably have two or three more episodes discussing our adventures because, I mean,
probably could.
Done so much together. I think this was fun.
Yeah. Yeah. It jogged my memory about a lot of things that were starting to, you know, work themselves into the fringe. It's hard to, you know, keep these memories fresh without talking about them every now and then. So I'm glad we did that.
Well, 30 years of adult adventures, and then another, you know, 15
20. Of kids. Yep. Yeah.
And you know, before we kick into the song, we record this about a week before you hear it live. And I just learned last night that Christopher Stanley died. He's a local musician that I've known for a long time. I'm going to see if I can get some people to talk about him because he was a real, really cool dude. It's a real shame. Every time that I hear another person from the scene passes, it's just a sad moment. I think one of the next episodes we'll play some of his music, chat about him for a minute. But in the meantime, let's close this one out. I appreciate having you on.
Yeah, man. We've been talking about this for a while, so I'm glad we finally did it. I'll be looking forward to hearing it on the interwebs.
Yep. Let's let's kick into that song. Y'all come back for the next one. Thanks.
We'll see ya.